not only expanding ACS facilities, but in assisting United States Army Alaska in expanding their facilities, setting up post telephone systems, and other communications that were required. Actually, ACS expanded between 1940 and 1944 to a force of over 2,000 men. Citations to units, and their record stands high among those of other military units in the United States Army. I will mention that ACS troops landed not only at Attu, but they were also located on Amchitka, Adak, Shemya, Atka, and Kiska. In addition to this, and perhaps one of the most important things to us today, is the part that the Alaska communication system played in providing communications for the construction, or that were required in the construction, of the Alcan Highway. This has helped Alaska to a great degree. In the post-war years, ACS provided new and improved means of communication for the civilians and military in Alaska. In 1947, Alaska was provided its first commercial service over landline. Another advancement about this time was the establishment of ship-to-shore communication. ACS currently maintains some 13 stations which serve the ship traffic in Alaska. And Alaska has a lot of ship traffic when you stop to realize that we have some 23,000 miles of coastline to this state. More than 1,200 vessels, incidentally, are registered in our service. A good majority of these ships are fishing vessels, which, of course, is one of the major means of livelihood in the state. On the 11th of December in 1956, in cooperation with the American Telephone and Telegraph Company, the Alaska Communication System inaugurated one of its newest communication facilities, this being a coaxial-type submarine cable stretching from Port Angeles, Washington, to Skagway, Alaska. This particular cable was constructed at a cost of some $20.25 million, $5.25 million of which was paid by the Alaska Communication System. This particular system is capable of handling today some 36 separate simultaneous channels of telephone communication, and each telephone channel is capable of handling by itself 18 channels of telegraph traffic. The most recent improvement in long-distance telephone service is the inauguration of operator toll dialing. Now, by this system, our operators at the Fairbanks station dial directly the subscriber that you are talking to or wish to talk to in the lower 48 or other connected areas. Actually, the system of the day would hardly be recognized by the far-seeing General Greeley. Today we operate in 48 widely separated communities in Alaska, in the larger populated areas, and we provide long-distance telegraph and telephone service to all governmental agencies and the general public. We also, at 13 additional points, provide service through agent station operations. Supplementing this system as it stands today, as I have mentioned it so far, are an additional 300 bush stations. Now, these bush stations are located in the remote and isolated areas or regions of the state, and this is their only means of connection or communication with the outside areas. Many of these stations are owned by individual miners, salmon canners, trappers, and just plain settlers. Some 60 of these stations are operated by the state of Alaska. Another 60 are operated by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. These, for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, I might add, are primarily located in the remote Bering Sea and the Arctic Ocean areas, and this really is their only way of getting the word out. These stations actually operate with radio, small transmitting and receiving stations from 50 to 150 watts in power. However, they do handle all telegrams and telegraph traffic that is required. In addition to providing the general public and the governmental agencies of communications between Alaska and the outside areas, the HCS provides telegraphic money service. It offers press service to newspapers, radio broadcasting stations, radio program service, such as the World Series game, an important stateside event, and many other services of this nature. I'd like to trace briefly, if I can, before this rain comes down too hard, a little bit of the service that is peculiar and particular to the Fairbanks area. It's desirable to note that Judge Wickersham in 1903 prevailed upon Captain Bunnell, who at that time was engaged in the construction of the Fort St. Michael, Fort Gibbons line, to drop a spur off into Fairbanks. The line at that time then was activated at Chena, the old small town of Chena, just south of where Fairbanks is located. And through Judge Wickerson's effort, Captain Bunnell did, in the fall of that year, drop off a line into Fairbanks, and in November of 1903, the first telegraph system, the first communication system, was inaugurated in Fairbanks. At this time, communications were possible then between Fairbanks and Nome, Fairbanks Valdez, and all of the waypoints in between. However, with the completion of the Valdez-Seattle cable in 1904, Fairbanks then was connected with the outside world. And from this modest beginning in Fairbanks, the Signal Corps rapidly expanded its services and improved communication facilities. In 1906, constructed a 200-foot tower, part of which is still standing in at the ACS ground. And in 1907, constructed the antennas that were used from it. And these facilities were improved. A telegraph station was built. A transmitting station was built. Both of these buildings, incidentally, are still in use. I'm referring to the Cushman Street building, and I might the other building happen to be at the present time my home. With the beginning of World War II, the ACS greatly expanded its facilities by building a landline from Fairbanks to Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. And it rebuilt the Alaska Railroad line from Fairbanks to Anchorage. This was the area that, or the time that Fairbanks was first received its telephone service to the outside world. In 1947, the ACS began a program of modernization of all stations in the system to bring the entire system in line with the modern improvements in the continental United States. New communications buildings and facilities have been added at Fairbanks at a cost of more than $2 million. Until today, the Fairbanks community is served with a communication system that matches in efficiency and modernization any long-distance telephone or telegraph system in the world. The improvement in the telephone speed of service and the quality of transmission has had a remarkable effect on the volume of telephone traffic handled by ACS in Fairbanks. And I would like to quote just a set of comparison figures. For instance, in June 1954, the ACS in Fairbanks completed an average of 539 Fairbanks-originated calls a day. In that same period in 1960, our Fairbanks station completed 2,217 calls average day. The daily projection by 1963 for this same period is expected to rise to 2,950. and by 1970 to 5,400. These are daily Fairbanks originated calls. Of course, I have stated that the increase in quality and facility has been responsible for this. This is but part of it. The growth of business and the population in Fairbanks has materially made this increase possible. I want to say that the improvement in facilities in Fairbanks is continuing. We are just now completing the installation of 9 new switchboard positions. We're installing many more long-distance trunks to Anchorage, to Juneau, Seattle, and Ketchikan. These are underway at the present time. And it may be of interest to you to know that in Fairbanks alone, our annual payroll runs some $700,000. A little bit about the future. I continue to receive inquiries concerning what ACS plans to do as far as direct distance dialing facilities and the provision of live television programs from the lower 48. I mentioned a few moments ago that the ACS uses a system referred to as operator toll dialing. I'd like to go into that just a little bit deeper for you. This is a system whereby if you wish to talk with someone in the lower 48, you dial the long distance operator, you dial 110, and you've got one of my operators, and you tell her then the party you wish to speak to. If you know the number of that party in, let's say, Chicago, Detroit, Hamtramck, Michigan, or any place in the lower 48, our operators will then immediately dial that number. And the voice that you hear comes back is a party you wish to talk to. Now, before direct distance dialing can be instituted, and as I speak of direct distance dialing, this means when you dial that number of your family in the lower 48 directly, instead of our operators, this cuts down time when this will be possible. But before this can be done, the city telephone company will have to install a tremendous amount of very expensive equipment. We feel that this is not economically feasible at the time in Alaska. I'd like to quote for you the cost of this type of operation. The Pacific Telephone Company in Seattle, for instance, has recently completed a long-term direct distance dialing program at a cost of some $14 million. I think that direct distance dial is a little bit in the future as far as Alaska is concerned. Concerning the provision of live television programs to Alaska, it is not likely in the near future. The cost of constructing conventional communication facilities capable of handling or transmitting TV programs between the United States and Alaska at the present time is most prohibitive. However, many advances are being made in reducing the cost of long-distance telephone, telegraph, and television services. Some of these stages are still in the embryo stages, but they do offer real promise, I would say, within the next 10 years. The use of space satellites for long-distance communications may be the answer to defendable and economical TV service to Alaska. However, the Signal Corps and the communication industry as a whole are watching these developments with interest, and you may be assured that ACS realizes the importance of providing all of the services to Alaskans that is provided to people in the other states, and as soon as it is economically feasible to do so, ACS will provide the facilities for live TV programs. Concerning the future of ACS, I'd like to state that the Secretary of the Army forwarded proposed legislation to Congress on the 3rd of January this year, which, if passed, will authorize the sale, or will authorize the Defense Department to dispose of any or all government lines in Alaska. The Secretary of the Army, in his letter, incidentally, to Congress, stated that the value of the Alaska communication system today was $20 million. And until definite action is taken on this proposed sale legislation, it is very difficult to say what the future of ACS will be. However, the ACS stands ready to continue its present mission of providing the communications and the communication facilities that do link this great state of Alaska with the other states in the world. In closing, I wish to express my appreciation to the Fairbanks Station for the very outstanding cooperation that has been given us by the municipal telephone companies, by the local civic organizations. And I'd like to thank you, Pioneers of Alaska, for this chance to tell a portion of the ACS story.
That was a speech by Major Bowers for Discovery Day, July 22nd, 1961, Fairbanks, Alaska. President Forb Baker presiding.
This is a tape recording of a speech made at the Golden Days Pedro ceremony where gold is discovered in 1902 in the Fairbanks area. This tape is not to be used in any manner, any illegal manner, and is protected by law. And this was recorded by Harry Hughes for Igloo 4, Pioneers of Alaska, at Fairbanks, Alaska, on July the 22nd, 1961. At the Pedro Memorial Ceremony being conducted by President Forbes Baker of Igloo 4, Pioneers of Alaska, on July the 22nd, 1961.
On good authority that we have a short presentation from the U.S. Mounting Company, Pioneer Jim Crawford. May we have a word from you? Pleasure to have an opportunity to say a few words here and make this little presentation as a measure of gratitude to the pioneers for the important and essential part they have played in making possible the success of gold mining, which led to the establishment of Fairbanks and has launched the run Fairbanks and the state on the transport event location. You're all more or less familiar with the interrelated history of Fairbanks, which will be a key role in other places. Pioneers underwent hardship on the trip list. Most frequently were decidedly not in their favor. And made the discoveries and brought production, gold, which has established upon which Fairbanks was established, and carried on, provided the backbone of the economy of interior Alaska for many years. These pioneers went even further than that. After the richer gold deposits of this area were worked out for practical purposes as far as individual gain and chances of individual enrichment were concerned, they continued on. Only through their help and industry and know-how that the later large-scale gold dredging operations that carried through this time were made successful. In view of this very important contribution, it gives me pleasure at this time and make a little presentation because I think it's most difficult to do and step up. It seems altogether appropriate that invite of this historic discovery by Felix Pedro that we place under the ownership and control of Hunter Glass. And therefore, please at this time to hand you a deed from the Land Search Development and Family Mining Company to the city number 4, Fire of Alaska, after conveying the Alaska Mining Company, after the Alaska Mining Company, better known as the Discovery Pedro Street, number 1750, first tracking number 985555. The smelting company greatly appreciates the help and assistance of the pioneers. I think that their thinking on the matter is best summed up in a portion of the letter that I have here that I received. And if I may, I'd like to read contract one. Dear Jim, we think the idea of presenting discovery Pedro to the pioneers of Alaska is excellent. We are much indebted to old Felix and the pioneers, and this is the least we can do in the spirit. Well, thank you, Jim. The pioneer Tim Crawford, on behalf of the group of the four pioneers of Alaska, I want to convey to you and through you to your mountain every company. I can't remember all of them. That's about all I can remember of them. The two of them are appreciated for this gift, and I believe that they are right in this building, but it does come back to the fire. And if you use of it, if years go by, it will be found to be great credit of your company. We all know exactly, most of us at least know exactly what the FD company wants to do with the town of Fairbanks and it did again. And we're down in a 1,500 population city. On our way out, I call flash and ran into the car. So,
come to the watershed of the Yukon before January 1908. And our Queen Regent is one of the members of our law. And the other ladies are down at the coffee and donut shop. So this is Mrs. Zimmerman from and Mrs. Kent.
Thank you very much. About for a speaker for this occasion, there were three possibilities that struck me as being very appropriate for the case of this time. One of them would be a representative of the post office department who has done so much to open up this great land of ours. Another was the military, and knowing wonderful work that old signal corps, now known as the Alaska, did in the pioneering Kamenaw Valley and the route between Alberta and the coast, that if we could prevail upon the member of that group, give us a resume of the history of the Signal Corps in Alaska, that this would be a wonderful occasion for us. I contacted Major Bowers, who's in charge of the Alaska in this area, especially in the forest, which he has done. I trust that it's a great deal of pleasure to introduce to you the speaker of the day, Major Bowers of the Alaska Communications Commission.
Pioneers of Alaska, King Johnson, Queen Brunetti, honored guests, ladies and gentlemen. It is indeed a personal pleasure for me to meet with you here this afternoon to pay commemorative respect to those individuals who by their acts contributed so greatly to the growth and the expansion of the Fairbanks area. I would like also for us to keep in mind those individuals and organizations who contributed to this growth and expansion, not only in the Fairbanks area, but to the state of Alaska as a whole. As Mr. Baker has pointed out, it is worthy of note at this time that foremost among the federal agencies who contributed to the exploitation and expansion of Alaska, a worthy post office, the federal judiciary, and the Alaska communication system. I would like at this time to specifically recognize Major C.J. Wooster, United States Army retired Signal Corps, for his many years of devoted and faithful service in the earlier periods of the Alaska Communication Systems operations in Alaska. I shall confine my remarks this afternoon to what might be called a brief ACS story. This story, however, is a direct reflection of Alaska's growth, as shown by a steadily increasing requirement for communications over a period of more than 60 years. The discovery of gold in the Klondike in 1896 and in Nome in 1898 is really what brought the Alaska communication system into Alaska. Fast on the heels of the prospectors came the various lawless elements, unsavory characters, and some of you may recall that law and order soon lost its way, and the requirement was placed upon the military by Congress to establish forts, camps, stations, and return the territory to a condition of stability. Subsequently, in May of 1900, Congress authorized and required the Army to construct a communication system to connect these camps and stations, authorizing an expenditure of some $450,000 to accomplish it. This actually was the birth of the Alaska communication system, then known as the Washington-Alaska Military Cable and Telegraph System, fondly referred to as the WOMCAT, which is perhaps a familiar term to some of you. The work on the system was started under General Greely, the dynamic and forceful Chief Signal Officer of the United States Army at the time, and he came into the territory and personally supervised the very rugged job that he was faced with. The Fort St. Michael, Fort Gibbons section of the line was completed in November of 1901. And this line stayed in communications, but for a very few short days, went out of service, was placed back in again in service, but stayed at that time only a few days, and the cable coming across Norton Sound was irretrievably damaged by polar ice pack conditions. However, the line was put back in from time to time in that early period. It totaled 605 miles in length, actually. It gave immediate telegraphic communications between Fort St. Michael's and Fort Gibbons, which was quite an improvement when you recall that in those days it took 29 days for mail between those two points. Fast on the heels of the second failure of the cable, General Greely turned to the then new science, if you will, of wireless telegraphy. And thanks to an officer in the Signal Corps by the name of Captain Wildwood, who made the necessary modifications to adapt a radio to Arctic conditions, wireless telegraphy became a fact in Alaska. It is believed that this use of wireless telegraphy, or radio if you will, was the first occasion in the history of communications when wireless telegraphy was used to transmit commercial type traffic. Certainly there was no other point-to-point communications in existence on the American continent at that time using this method of communication. In the autumn of 1901, a troubleshooter by the name of Lieutenant William Mitchell was sent up here from the tropics. This particular Lieutenant William Mitchell later gained fame as General Billy Mitchell for his foresight and his outstanding predictions in the role of air power. He working from the north and Captain Bunnell working from the south completed the connections that brought the Valdez and the Prince William Sound areas into communications through the Canadian circuits with the rest of the world. Now, this great length of wire running its entire length in almost uninhabited wilderness, was maintained by a very remote group of men, stationed about every 40 miles along the line. The Alaska communication system had groups of 3 to 4 men living in cabins, traveling on this line, keeping it in shape, traveling by dog and sled. And it is interesting to note that during the year 1903, some 3 of these men, of the 105 who maintained this line, did lose their lives in repair duty. By the summer of 1903, the United States possessed a cable and telegraph system that linked all of the military garrisons of Alaska and connected those garrisons through the Canadian government line with Washington. It's interesting to note that linked also at this time in this system were the cities of Nome, Rampart, Eagle, Valdez, Skagway, and Juneau, and many of these smaller and lesser towns. As these telegraphs were being installed from point to point within Alaska, there still remained the fact that there was no means of communicating directly with the United States except through the Canadian circuits. And this was really not to the liking of the United States Army, and a decision was made to install submarine cable directly from Sitka, Alaska to Juneau. Accordingly, in 1903, the Army cable ship Burnside was brought from the Philippines, and during the summer of 1903, laid the first submarine cable from Sitka to Juneau, a distance of about 291 miles. This same ship returned the following year and laid first a cable from Sitka to Seattle, a distance of some 1,070 miles, coming back again to lay the cable from Sitka to Valdez, another some 600-odd miles. Now, these 3 submarine cables were completed by 1904. And with the completion of the installation of these cables, direct communication then was possible over American lines directly into the United States. The network at this time consisted of some 2,128 miles of submarine cable, 1,500 miles of landline, and a wireless system that I have previously mentioned over a water gap of approximately 100 miles. Actually, if you plotted this system on a map of the United States, the system would have stretched from Wyoming to the Bahamas, the cable system, and the landlines from Washington to Texas. During the years 1904 to the beginning of World War II, the history of the system is a story of service with token advancement. However, it is worthy of note that during these years, very important and vital service was provided to such flights as the dirigible Norge and its flight from Spitsbergen to Teller. The Alaska communication system provided valuable service in the Nome fire of 1934, and also in providing ground communication for the various American-Russian polar flight later in that period. The ACS story is not without its humorous incidents. Incidentally, there have been many instances of communications going out for unknown reasons, perhaps to find a moose entangled in the lines and unable to extricate himself. There was a period on one of the Valdez sub cable, for instance, when a humpback whale decided to tangle with the cable, which he did very successfully, tying it in knots, stretching it to almost its extreme. But the cable, incidentally, stayed in service, but the whale had the last word because his body decomposed. The chemical reaction finally did the story, and the cable did expire in its watery grave and have to be replaced. There have been many of these instances that have tried the patience of the Army signalman and his ingenuity, but we've looked on this as pretty much in a day's work. In the summer of 1940, when the war clouds of World War II were forming in all directions, the United States hastily began a task that had long postponed, and that was the adequate establishment of post camps and stations within the territory. And from a comparably small commercial type operation of less than 200 men, the Alaska communication system suddenly expanded into a combination Army theater communication network and a major tactical communication service. Actually, the system operated over an area as great as any theater known in World War II. And this was coupled with the vast problems of unusual climatic conditions and terrain that was not found in other theaters. Actually, it was at this time that the War Department took another look at ACS and decided that they did have a veritable storehouse of knowledge among the communicators here in Alaska, and they were put to great use in not only expanding ACS facilities, but in assisting United States Army Alaska in expanding their facilities, setting up post-telephone systems.